Good morning. This is today. It's April 22nd, Earth Day. When in the course of evolution it becomes necessary for one species to denounce the notion of independence from all the rest. So read the first words of this Declaration of Interdependence, a respectful non-political parody of our famous political document, the Declaration of Independence, but a very important concept. It was conceived by the environmental group Ecology Action, and it calls upon mankind to recognize that people, all of us, have been the villains and that we must reaffirm our interdependence with other forms of life on Earth, or all perish. And all of these symbols that have come to have meaning, that relate to Earth Day and Earth Week, are going to be familiar sights, I think, on the more or less from here on. These are some of the patches, for example, one that says pollution. There are many of them that are new that I'm not even aware of what the actual meaning is. But you'll see lots of, there are lots of buttons and slogans and symbols and stickers and so forth. And they will be used by people who are joining, individually and in groups, the great movement for survival for the Earth. And we use the term survival, seems like a dramatic term, but it's a dramatic situation. And that's what it boils down to, is whether we're going to survive. We want to show you how some people in Philadelphia are doing their part in this movement during this half hour. Well, this is the day for which workers in the environmental movement have been planning for many months now. It's also the third in our five-day series on the environmental crisis. We're exploring the grassroots sentiment of the ecology movement today and concerning ourselves with the social implications of the struggle to cleanse and to save our environment. Among other things, you'll be hearing from today reporter-at-large Paul Cunningham.
Here on 14th Street in New York City, in Union Square Park, not many people have arrived yet. Not many run-of-the-mill New Yorkers. Most of them down here right now are the young people who are out here putting up booths. The traffic is still going on 14th Street, and as I say, not many of the ordinary New Yorkers. It's worth it for them to come here, though. Two reasons. A free breath of fresh air from a huge bubble. Also, a New Yorker's survival kit, how to survive in polluted New York City. Hopefully, they'll arrive later today. Paul Cunningham, NBC News. Now back to Hugh Downs in the studio.
We'll also be talking in this hour with a Louisiana tugboat captain, or a charter boat captain, rather, a Negro publisher from San Francisco, a college professor from Idaho, and we'll see some of the activities on around the nation on this Earth Day. We'll start with the news. Here is Frank Blair.
Earth Day demonstrations began in practically every town and city in the United States this morning, the first massive nationwide protest against the pollution of the environment. Co-eds went to pollution teach-ins wearing gas masks. Small children on the way to school cleaned litter from the streets. Many cities, including New York, banned the automobile from at least one major street. At Jamestown, New York, the Kiwanis Club arranged to dump 20 tons of sand in a downtown area to show just how much dirt falls in a square mile of the city in just 30 days of maximum air pollution. In Ashtabula, Ohio, demonstrators set up what was called a funeral for unborn children, possible future victims of the environment. In Washington, the House and Senate adjourned for the day. Practically every senator and congressman was off to make speeches on the year's most popular and least risky election issue. But there was a pre-Earth Day rally in New York's Wall Street, and Senator Jacob Javits, voicing the concern of many national leaders, cautioned against letting pollution overwhelm other vital national issues.
I'm concerned that this fight against environmental and physical pollution is so popular that it will tout us off, to use a New York phrase, it will tout us off the long-standing and at least equally vital effort to deal with poverty, alienation, racial tensions, the gross inadequacy of health services, education, housing, and intelligent population control, and the ending of the war in Vietnam.
The Wall Street crowds broke into song to express their protest. Later today, to show concern for automobile pollutants, New York will close part of famed Fifth Avenue to auto traffic, and Mayor Lindsay was keeping appointments in an electric car. In Philadelphia, where the Declaration of Independence was signed, demonstrators at another pre-Earth Day rally signed a so-called Declaration of Interdependence, dramatizing the point that every man depends on his fellows and on nature to help keep the environment livable. 2,000 ghetto residents were boycotting another Philadelphia rally today. arguing that the nation's newfound infatuation with the environment has distracted attention from the misery of the poor. For a look at the polluted center of the nation's biggest city, New York, at the start of the rush hour this morning, here is Paul Cunningham at Manhattan's 14th Street.
Even the most chauvinistic New Yorker would probably not consider his city beautiful. Yet, like it or not, he's going to get some beauty here. The Environmental Action Coalition, which is sponsoring Earth Day in New York and concentrating here on Union Square, says this is the first step toward restoring New York's original beauty. Besides a mammoth teach-in here and booths devoted to wilderness, open space, wildlife, solid waste, air, water, population, urban health, noise pollution, and there's certainly that in Manhattan, Union Square will be scrubbed clean. There's no telling what they'll find underneath the dirt. Part of 14th Street here will be banned to motor vehicles. Instead, they'll be riding bicycles, electric cars, and even roller skates. But the biggest treat for New Yorkers may be a large dome, a bubble, where they can get a breath of fresh air free. And that's well worth the trip down here to 14th Street. Paul Cunningham, NBC News on Union Square.
And this morning, with millions of Americans demonstrating for a better environment, a look at a small band of American Indians whose demonstration for much the same end has been underway without interruption for more than 5 months. It was last November that the Indians seized Alcatraz Island, and this morning they're still there, their goal still not reached.
The Indians who claim Alcatraz Island have settled into a routine of waiting on this rock, which the government decided was not fit for a prison, much less for normal life. 100 or so Indians, including children, actually eat, sleep, and live here during the week. Others come over on visits and on weekends using their chartered boat, the Bass Tub. The militant Indians have demanded title to Alcatraz by May 31st. The snag with Washington is whether the government or the Indians would have final control of whatever program they may agree upon.
Right now, it doesn't make a difference, really, what Washington does. There's only one way now that Washington can ever stop this, and that's to come out here with armed troops and take us forcibly off of here.
What would you do now?
I'd fight. If they got me off, I'd still come back. They couldn't keep me off.
Frank Burkholzer, NBC News, reporting from Alcatraz.
This is the state seal of Louisiana. The bird is the brown pelican. There used to be hundreds of thousands of these birds off the Louisiana coast and on the coast. Now there are less than 50, according to some estimates. Now, we have a picture of a few of the survivors. Now, these are not even native Louisiana pelicans. These have been imported from Florida several years ago, but these two are dying off. Now, what happened to the pelicans of Louisiana?
Insecticide.
Well, you can start by answering. I just wanted to introduce you. Our guest is is well-versed on the subject. He is a charter boat captain. His name is Charles Sebastian, and welcome to today. Yeah, what is the answer? What did happen to the pelicans?
Insecticides captain? Coming down the Mississippi River. As far as 750 miles away, a plant in the Mississippi River put out a tremendous amount of insecticide, killed fish all the way into the Gulf of Mexico. And these fish who had absorbed this insecticide into their systems were eaten, picked up in the food chain of the pelican. The quickest way to get rid of any species is to keep them from propagating. And what the insecticide does is to prevent the female from laying eggs that have sufficient shell, calcium in the shell. Shell breaks, you have no new crop of pelicans, and all at once you're out of pelicans.
Captain Sebastian has spent the last 24 years as a charter boat captain taking sport fishermen into the Gulf to the best spots there for fishing. And in 1968, he was awarded the Louisiana Governor's Conservation Award for his efforts to alert the public to the dangers of pollution of the Gulf. We talked a little about that yesterday and what the dangers are. When you began running a charter boat in 1946, as I understand it, there were no oil drilling platforms in the Gulf. Now, the fishing was very good there in almost any spot that you choose.
Yes, we had very good fishing even then, but the fishing has greatly improved since the advent of these huge offshore drilling platforms in the Gulf of Mexico.
Now, well, do they act like a reef?
They act just like a reef. It's a food shade and shelter cycle. Uh-huh. And the fish tend to congregate around these huge offshore platforms, and it has made my job of finding fish much easier. This is true. But we have such a proliferation of these things that now the tide is starting to swing, and we're being affected adversely by them.
Is that threatened now? I mean, will there
be... Well, we simply don't know, and this is the answer we must give many times. We don't know enough about what is going on. I would like to stress that our fishing off the Louisiana coast right now is tremendously good, and I want to keep it that way. That is my worry. Why?
What
may be
that
happening. We don't know what is happening.
Let's take a look at some of the photographs that you brought that show some of the pollution going on down there now.
Here's a pipeline break. March the 25th of this year, I believe, was the date in Barataria Bay, which is right behind Grand Isle. About 4,000 barrels of oil, I understand, were spilled here. And this is a marsh set on fire and the oil in the marsh being burned out. Here's some more shots of a helicopter with the crew in there trying to burn this oil out of the marsh. Now, you say, what difference does it make if we dilute and pollute and lose a little marsh? Well, the marsh is the nursery for everything. Everything that's in the Gulf of Mexico either comes from this marsh or spends some of its time in that marsh or feeds on something that came out of that marsh.
You
destroy the marsh, that's it.
There
is no more nursery.
What has been the reaction of companies involved in this to your efforts to alert the public? Have they cooperated?
They are cooperating. Yes, the oil companies are doing the best they know how. But a great deal of research needs to be done.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what do you think specifically should be done step by step to save fishing industry in the Gulf?
The first thing, we must have research money. We need research programs to tell us what is happening, these insecticides, the chemical and oil pollution. We live on the Alimentary Canal of the United States, the Mississippi River, and near the anus of it in the Gulf of Mexico. Everything that comes down the Mississippi River is deposited in the Gulf of Mexico. 2/3 of the solid waste and waste of the United States are deposited in this Gulf of Mexico. Look at this oil that was a spillage from a tanker, or rather a barge that overflowed in Bayarigo right behind Grand Isle. This is in our dock where we keep our boats. A tankerman went to sleep and let this oil spill. Here's a flare in the Gulf of Mexico that burns so much crude oil, at times the crude oil slugs through there, that it actually falls in the water. Part of it burns and leaves tremendous slicks. We are told frequently that we have shortages of natural gas in the United States. Well, there are billions of cubic feet of gas wasted in the Gulf of Mexico and in southern Louisiana every year through flares like that underwater flare you see there. Here's a Grand Isle spill of this year, January the 28th, I believe, was the date. And we had oil all up and down our beach. It was a terrible mess.
I want to thank you, Captain Sebastian. We're up against a station break now. We'll be back in a few moments. We're back now with Captain Sebastian, and who brought along... if you're eating breakfast, we apologize, but you might as well see what can happen in an... What is this? Is that oil?
This is oily tire residue that comes from tankers that ply all the oceans of the world. And this was picked up in about a block off of the Grand Isle Beach the day before I flew up here.
Now, that will not dissolve in
this. And anything except Varsol, kerosene, diesel oil, or something like that. You get it on your feet, it's difficult to take, almost impossible to take off. Now, this is not a problem that's peculiar to Grand Isle. Hawaii, Jersey coast, Florida coast, any place you go, you're going to find this stuff on the beach. It comes from tankers. Over 250,000 tons of crude oil are spilled into the waters of the world every year. I said tons, not gallons or pounds. 250,000 tons. And we're going to get more and more of this sort of thing as we move more and more oil by tankers.
Now, is this an accident or is it flushing bunkers?
No, this is deliberate. This is the residue of bunker C, which is used for fuel in most cases. And after it's concentrated down and all the usable fractions used off, this is a goop that's left. They pump it over the side, it floats on top of the water, and eventually it's going to come on somebody's beach somewhere in the world. The Rivieras has this problem.
Eventually, wouldn't it have to come about that one of the worst crimes you could commit would be to pollute the environment in that way, and there would have to be stringent international laws about it, I would
say. Yes, this is an international problem, and it's being worked on, but much, much too slowly. Tanker captains must be a heartless group of people, and I say that in all sincerity, because how could anybody pump all this stuff into the water near or close to a swimming beach, a recreational area, knowing that sooner or later it's going to end up there.
Now, as things now stand, is there another place for them to put it? I mean, could they in port someplace, make a proper disposition of it where it would be?
Certainly. Recent? This could be held in the vessels and brought back to shore and pumped into tanks and recycled into road building material.
So it would even be usable.
Surely. This has a use.
Yes.
That's where road tar comes from. It's the final better end of the crude oil.
How can it be policed? You know, we can have, when you and I have boats out, the Coast Guard can come aboard to see if we've got holding tanks. And
that's right.
How can you police the high seas now to make sure somebody doesn't do that?
It is impossible under our present regulations. There are regulations against it, but they are not enforceable at the present time. Now, I'm doing everything as you are on your boat operation to clean up my boat operation. I carry a garbage can on my boat, and everything that we take aboard, beer cans, disposable bottles, 78 billion disposable cans and bottles in the United States a year are put out. Now, I put all of mine in a garbage can, bring it back ashore. At the end of a day, six or eight fishermen will fill a 30-gallon garbage can with refuse. I put it back in the system. I don't pump my oily bilges in the water. I'm now trying to find a chemical toilet to take care of my boat. I'm going to clean up my system as best as to the nearest possible degree of cleanliness, hoping someone else will follow.
Well, that kind of example is a good thing to set, I think. And I hope that when the laws do come in, they don't immediately crack down on the consumer in a way. Sometimes that's good as a reminder to have laws that we should follow. But very often, something like laws about holding tanks on board a private yacht, when ocean liners aren't required to dump their raw sewage in the bay.
You get to dock, where do you dump your holding tank? There's no facility there. Yeah. So you've got to...
They're gradually putting those in,
yes,
I understand,
this is true.
In various places. So that maybe as the thing snowballs, and if we get people like Captain Sebastian and other guests we've had on the program, and we'll have the rest of this week, to show the example, we'll be able to get sensible legislation. And certainly people will be more inclined to follow it, I think, if it's their own environment and they're going to have to live with it. We all have to live with it. So maybe we'll all cooperate. We can hope. Thanks very much, Captain Sebastian.
Thank you, Mr. Downs. It was a pleasure.
We're back now at 30 minutes after the hour on today, on Earth Day, Wednesday, April 22. And in this half hour, we'll be talking with a Negro publisher who has some very well-defined thoughts on the environment issue. And we want to take a look at what's happening along the Snake River in Idaho and Oregon. Let me show you right now two very different aspects of the environmental deterioration problem. These tree stumps that you see here are not typical of the... of the region there in Idaho and Oregon, but they are a danger signal for some far-sighted Idaho-Oregon people, and they're forming the first overall regional planning group to correct the mistakes of the past and see that this beautiful area doesn't succumb to destruction. If those of you who may have missed a portion of our program in which Captain Charles Sebastian, who's a charter boat captain in the Gulf of Mexico, brought along to show you, at the risk of spoiling your breakfast, I'd like you to see what the problem we hear about the flushing the sludge from bunkers out in the oceans that later comes in. It's oil, really, oil and grease, that comes into somebody's beach and ruins it. This is the kind of sludge that he was showing. That does not dissolve in water. It kills birds. It ruins beaches. The economic impact alone is terrible. The aesthetic impact is ghastly. And there's a need for international policing of this kind of irresponsible action. The Snake River is a tributary of the mighty Columbia. It rises in Idaho. It flows north between Idaho and Oregon. It's one of the most dramatically beautiful river valleys in the world, curving past majestic mountains and placid meadowlands. At points, the canyon of the Snake is deeper than that of the Grand Canyon of the Colorado. Well, 4 years ago, two men became very concerned with what was going to happen to this land as our affluent civilization began to move in on it. They conceived a plan for a Snake River environmental study. And now, by virtue of a $100,000 grant, that study is becoming a reality. And one of these men is with us this morning. We welcome him to today. He is Dr. Lyle Stanford, professor of biology at the College of Idaho in Caldwell. Is that right?
Yes.
Happy to have you here, Dr. Caldwell. Is this the first time that such a regional study has been attempted involving universities and industries and government?
So far as we know, at the time we started this, it certainly was true. We're pretty sure now that we're still pretty much in the lead in this kind of a regional study.
Now, before I find out what you're finding out, I'd like to ask you, when you have mounted this study, is there a way to be sure that it's used by government people in a way that can give the maximum assurance that this beauty will be saved?
I think so. This, of course, is our main effort in this study, is to make it possible to educate our region, which is principally a pioneer region. They still have the pioneer spirit. Some people say cowboy attitude, and we've got to get beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Now, what has been the reaction to, I mean, how have the industries or the government or local and state governments responded to your approach?
We're new at this, but we've worked at it 4 years in the preparation, and during that time, our contacts with industry have been numerous. Just since we received the grant, the number of industries that have called us, asked to come and see us, agencies that have made themselves known, has been a rather astonishing number. We're very grateful that they seem to be picking up the idea rapidly. Now, just how we're going to make the contact, I think, will be something that'll have to develop.
Again, I ask all of our guests this, but are you hopeful that until the population of the Earth is controlled, let's assume that it will be controlled, level off at some place, and during the interim period of growth, will it be possible for industries to come into the area and to deal with the wastes of their wastes in such a way that it doesn't ruin this valley?
We have a very serious water pollution problem in our region. Proportion to our population is as bad as any place in the nation, I feel. But we're still a young region with a low population. If we can control the industries we have and thus set a sort of an example, I think we can go a long ways towards expecting the other industries to fall in line when they come in. We may be able to choose them, actually.
Mm-hmm.
This, I think, is an important point for us.
Part of the plan,
yes,
it would be
right.
Essential, yes. And that covers quite a bit of land.
It's 110,000 square miles. It's a very large area.
Yes.
Yes, this is the kind of country we like to keep in good condition.
Well worth preserving. That's a curious thing about the nature of our problem now and the acuteness of it, is that we've always had, humans have always polluted their environments since the old Stone Age, but the Earth could handle it.
Right.
And now there's so many of us, and our power, our energy demands are so much that it's overwhelming the Earth. I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Stanford, and telling us about a study to save a very beautiful part of the world. Environment in the 1950s was something which, of course, affected man. It was used as a pivotal argument in the 1954 Supreme Court decision, which stated that equality of education could not be attained in a segregated environment. In the 60s, many underprivileged groups, including blacks, grew disenchanted with the fruits of liberal legislation, and so equality and the effect of environment were discounted in favor of asserting innate distinctiveness and even, in some cases, superiority. Well, now, in the 70s, environment is back. But now it's not what it does to mankind. The new issues are what we are doing to the environment. And we found an interesting view of the environment crisis in a magazine called Urban West. It was contained in an article by the publisher, John C. Bee, Jr., of San Francisco, and we want to welcome him this morning.
Thank you.
You concur with some blacks who say that the environment argument is a cop-out by some people who are interested in dodging other thorny issues, such as war and race and health, poverty, and so forth. But you say that it's a dangerous cop-out, and would you explain why?
Well, I think it's a dangerous cop-out mainly because the environment is deteriorating, and many people haven't come to grips with the real issues. And our real concern was that this wouldn't just be another issue, that it would have meaning. Now, many people that live in ghettos, and especially black people, feel that, you know, the problems that they have talked about, the environmental problems in the ghetto areas, poor garbage collection, sewage, areas located close to plants and factories where you have stench and these types of things, these people have talked about it for years, but nothing has been done. And I think in a social sense, beyond the current ecology and environmentalism concerns, that it has meaning. It shows that the people are so powerless that these problems have been there. But not until middle-class America has become concerned that we are, generally as a nation, giving some attention to environmentalism.
Yes, this also throws a spotlight on the intimate interrelation between these problems that some people think are separate, maybe. You know, that if various forms of life on this planet have to get along together, then certainly humans have to get along together.
Precisely.
With social injustice, it would be related directly to the environment crisis, wouldn't
it?
Well,
I think many people talk about the pollution of racism, which is definitely a social issue, but I think it's... has something to do with the ecological balance in the country.
Surely. Now you write, here's a quote, "The environment issue assumes a deep skepticism about the value of personal success."
Goes to the core of the whole American tradition of free enterprise. I think most of us have become conditioned to thinking about production, you know, more production, more gadgets. A man could put a factory any place he likes and produce, as long as he produces goods that are marketable. You know, this is good. So I think we are coming to the core of this, that maybe this is not the most important thing in society. And I think most of us have been conditioned to think to produce the industrialist, the great producer. I think much of our system is geared on, based on free enterprise. And
that consumer...
Consumerism.
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah, that is interesting, because do you think there is, in the awakening now, we see it, particularly in a day like this Earth Day, in the awakening, do you think there are people who see the desperate necessity to change the quality of life and not merely go on a quantitative basis, which is what we've tended to do in our American growth?
I'm not sure. We are hoping. I think this type of effort here that NBC is doing this week will help. But I still feel that because much research and many plants and delivery systems for industry are still being developed, but I think the consequences of taking the resources from the earth are not still fully understood.
That's interesting. It ties in with something you published where you said once that we're shocked now to find that wealth may destroy us even worse than poverty, because it is a bigger danger if it means exploiting.
Sure. How would you like to see 700 million rich Chinese in China?
Each with the energy demands that the average American has.
Ecological balance in China would be changed.
That would eat up the earth in a faster hurry. Are you hopeful generally that we'll find our way out of the woods? The thing seems to be snowballing now, and it's a terrible tide to try to stem. Do you think that the efforts of things like Earth Day and the aroused people will get things going on a massive enough scale to reverse this tide, or are you one of the doom mongers?
Well, I am a doom monger in the sense that I've seen other issues develop, and then after they are no longer fashionable or in vogue, to lose impetus. In the 60s, we had the big push for civil rights. And then when you really analyze and look at what has actually happened,
that's right,
the attitudes and all are the same. I think we're more sophisticated in practicing these things. So it just seems to me that if other great issues of my generation are any precedent, that pollution and environmentalism and ecology and these concerns might be verbiage and all.
I hope you're wrong.
I indeed hope, because all of us are going to be affected by
surely
industry as well as government and private citizens.
Well, thank you for appearing with us this morning.
My pleasure.
Our guest, John C. D. Jr., John C. B., who is the founder of a magazine called Urban West.